in thinking in terms of the task of life management, the reason why I've got this handout is because we've been trying to sort of consolidate some ideas on a one-page handout for business people. And this is one that I worked on and have used it in several situations in some of the studies that I've been doing with men and so forth in Amarillo. So this is sort of a compilation and a condensation of some of the things we've been talking about. You know, any comments or things that we're going through, I'll write them down and we'll put it in the computer and kind of do some things with it so we make it more effective. But as on that top part there, it says we all have the task of managing life and life's demands in such a way, and I put all our responsibilities, because we, as a worker, as a husband, as a father, as, you know, in the church, and all the responsibility we have, you know, we have that responsibility to juggle all this stuff. And that they're met and none are neglected. Now that's a tall order. And it does have to do with priorities. And I think a lot of times if we can't juggle the balls, maybe we've made some wrong decisions as to what we're juggling. Or, you know, we're not realistic in our time. There's a lot of factors and we'll go through those. But so in order to have harmony or a balance in life, we have to come up with some basic assumptions that are what I call foundational or bedrock, or they don't change throughout life. That there's some priorities, there's some assumptions that I'm basing my life upon that never change. Now the circumstances change and the responsibilities change and the seasons of life cause things to change. But I've got a bedrock here that is the foundation from which I am drawing, you know, those decisions in life. And so if I have a bedrock or a foundation, then I'm able to withstand the constant changes and demands of life as we progress through the stages of life from where we are now till death. Why don't we just put a little pause on that? So we're progressing through the stages of life, and I look around the room and I see all of the stages represented here. From you young men who are in the process of deciding your life vocation and where you're going, and you're part of that training process that you're going through, to guys who are in the process, you're already in place in the vocation and the things that you're doing, and you're starting families and, you know, newly married and those kind of things. And I see other men who are in other stages where your kids are leaving home and you're progressing towards kind of an emptiness situation. And there's a new dimension and new demands on that. And I see other men who have already gone through that process and you know, have another responsibility with grandkids and managing life, and we're constantly managing life until we take the last gasp. And like Ecclesiastes says, there's no discharge in that battle. That life's demands keep going until you take your last gasp. And that's true of purity of life. That's true of demands that are upon you from your family and others and your responsibility to God, that there's no time when we're eased of that responsibility. There's no discharge in that battle. And if you talk to men who are on their last, you know, in the hospital, and ask them, when did you sort of overcome the lust of the flesh or the lust of the eyes or the pride of life, and they're still in the battle. I mean, there's no discharge. There's never a time when we can kind of load up our motorhome and drive off in the sunset and retire from the Christian life and kind of coast on out. It just doesn't happen. That's a fictitious unreality. So, as I look at life, we all desire a life that's not in vain. One that counts. One that Jesus can say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." And I've got a little quotation in the Amplified down the bottom of your sheet there of Ephesians 5, 15 through 17, I think gives us a framework from how we look at life and life management. It says, "Look carefully then how you walk. Live purposefully and worthily and accurately, not as the unwise and witless, but as wise, sensible, and intelligent people, making the very most of your time and buying up each opportunity." Why? Because the days are evil, and I didn't put that in there. "Therefore, do not be vague or thoughtless or foolish, but understand and firmly grasp what the will of the Lord is." And it, I mean, we could stop right there, couldn't we? Because that's all-inclusive. Don't live life in a vague, thoughtless, foolish manner. But understand and firmly grasp what the will of the Lord is, so that you can live purposefully, worthily, and accurately. Not as the unwise and witless, but as wise, sensible, intelligent people. And isn't that's the challenge of life, isn't it? And that will determine whether we end well or don't end well. And so as we look at that, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of a couple of statements, but I have a little cartoon here. I don't know about you, but I kind of am a fan of this Kathy thing in the paper. And here's a little cartoon that says, "Our secretary can type for you," and she says, "I'm not a secretary, I'm a computer analyst who's in a transitional position." And the other one says, "Well, you know, the accountant can do that." "No, I'm not an accountant, I'm a bass guitarist." You know? And, "Well, I'm not a bookkeeper, I'm a screenwriter." And then the next one he says, "You know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a cowboy." And I see guys, you know, in Amarillo who are professional guys, but it's the ranch that really keeps them going. You know, they're out there with the cattle, see? And then we say he's maybe all hat and no cattle, but... So he says, this guy said, "You know, I'm not a receptionist, I'm a cabaret singer. And I'm not an administrator, you know, I'm something else." And then it goes on, and the boss comes around and he says, "For heaven's sakes, people, snap out of your little fantasies and get back to business." And the guy says, "Well, I'm not a client, I'm a big law..." He says, "You know, I'm not a boss, I'm just a babysitter of all these people." And maybe if you're in business, you feel like that. Everybody can't own up their problem. And I thought, well, this last one kind of describes life. He says, "You know, I'd feel a lot safer if he hadn't brought those two woodpeckers on the ark." Everybody's chipping away. So, but, you know, that's true. And as we look at that, for the benefit of you guys that don't have one of these sheets, the first principle, and we'll cover those two, the first principle of ethical power is purpose. And by purpose I mean your objective or intention, something toward which you are always striving. Purpose is something bigger. It's the picture you have of yourself, the kind of person you want to be, or the kind of life you want to live. That's what we're talking about. And that next little, the purpose is more of an ongoing thing. It gives meaning to our lives. When people have a purpose in life, they enjoy everything they do more. People go on chasing goals to prove something that doesn't have to be proved. That's an interesting statement. That they're already worthwhile. They are already worthwhile. They don't have to prove that. They are worthwhile. The fastest way to achieve goals the successful salesperson says is to stay on purpose. These are some quotes out of a little book called On Purpose, The On Purpose Person. And, you know, as we look at that, purpose is something bigger, something that you give your life to, the broad direction as to where you're going. And people are chasing goals, but if you don't have the purpose for the goals, you're going to chase the wind. And that's the whole statement of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? Chasing the wind. And how many men do you know who have gone three-quarters of the way through their career or halfway through their career and they feel like they're chasing the wind? And they're discouraged. And in fact, polls that are taken with management that, you know, up to 70% in some of the polls of people are dissatisfied with where they are and what they're doing. And what I'm trying to figure out and trying to put here is that if I have some bedrock convictions and directions as to where I'm going, I won't end up like that. And you won't. And so this first assumption that I'm making here, if you look on the sheet, the first assumption that I have to make is that God has to be the foremost center or core, the number one place in a man's life to give you purpose. And if God isn't the first in your life, you're going to have this fleeting purpose like goals that just keep fleeting around and you never can quite put your finger on it. And never quite end up where you want to arrive. And that's exactly what Jesus talks about in Mark 12. Thou shalt love what? The Lord your God with all. With all of your what? Heart, soul, mind, and strength. And if you look at that in life, that's it. Is there anything more than heart, soul, strength, and mind? Nothing. And as I did a little study on that, the heart in that context represents the emotions of life. And God is saying, hey, I want you to love me with all of your emotions. And, you know, that's a challenge in itself, just thinking about it. And when you look at the psalmist where he's crying and laughing and singing and dancing and, you know, the whole, all that, he's loving God with those emotions. And I used to pride myself in the fact that I didn't want to have emotions. You know, I was objective and, you know, I'm an engineer or something like that. Man, those emotions, let's get them out of the way because I don't want to deal with that kind of stuff. But I'm having to learn and love God with those emotions. And God wants me to do that. And then the soul, love God with all of your soul, means your will. That's your purpose. That's your drive. That's the thing that you say, I will or I won't or I'll do or I can or, you know. I mean, that's where you're going. And God wants you to love Him with all of your will. And then all of your intellect. That's an interesting discussion in itself. How do you love God with your intellect, with your thinking capacity, with your brain? And most people, like Howie Hendricks says, that they die at age 27 and are buried at age 67. That somehow you get through college and you set your brain aside and you drift. And really, what God is saying in Mark 12, you need to be a lifelong learner and developer of your intellect so that you can love me more, so that you can serve me more, you know? And that, I mean, if that isn't a motivation for being a man of the Word of God and the Scripture and using the faculty and the capacity that you and I have to be lifelong learners, I don't know what is. And it's a sad thing when you meet people who have quit learning and quit developing in the area of loving God with your emotions and with your will and with your intellect. And it's a sad thing when we quit loving God with our body, because it will deteriorate. If any of you have occasion to do maintenance on old houses or something like that, or your house, what happens if you kind of drift and let it go? I mean, it collapses around you. It's amazing. And that's exactly what our bodies will do, or our minds will do, if we don't keep on growing and learning and developing and expanding out. And it's part of loving God. And as you look at 1 Corinthians 6:19, that quotation, what is that about? Yeah, our bodies are a living temple where God dwells. And he says, you're bought with a price, therefore you glorify God in your body, which is what? Which is his. And I think that's one of the biggest theological things to get over, is that every one of us sitting here, if we're redeemed by the blood of Christ, it says we're not our own, we're bought with a price, therefore you glorify God in your body, which is his. He bought it, he paid for it, and you glorify me in your body. I mean, speaking of Christ. And you think about that, I mean, that blows circuits, doesn't it? And that's why Jesus could say, I want you to love me with all of your heart and soul and strength and mind, because I bought you. You're not your own. And isn't that what we talked about last night of lordship? Is the transferring of the title to our lives from ourselves to God, and signing the dotted line and saying, whatever you want, Lord, wherever you go, whatever, I'm yours. And that's what lordship is. And we wrestle, don't we? Wrestle with that. And we wrestle it in different stages of life too, don't we? We're fed a lot of garbage from the world that says that we have the ownership. And if you just have assertive training, or you just do this, or you just do that, then you'll be happy. And God says, no. You put me at the center. And you live for me as the core of your life. And then, that's the secret of happiness. Matthew 6:33, a verse we all know. Seek who first? Or what first? His kingdom. And then what? His righteousness. And then what? And then we've got the promise. All these things shall be added unto you. The very things that we're looking for, the very things that we're seeking, come only through putting Him first. And then they come as a benefit. They come as a serendipity, as it were, something that God just puts in there. And when you get it, you rejoice and you're encouraged and you're happy and you use it. But if you're seeking it, it vaporizes. It has a way of going away. And men who seek wealth or whatever, it has a way of fleeting, like it says, like the bird out of the cage. And it goes. Well, that's the same way of John 15, of the vine and the branches. And Jesus makes the pronouncement in John 15, 3 and 5. What does he say? Okay, I'm the vine. You're the branches. Abide in me. For without me, you can do how much? Zip. Now that's in the context of spiritual fruit, isn't it? It's not in the context. I mean, if I go up to a guy who's a great carpenter and say, hey, without Christ, you can't do a carpenter work, and he can laugh in my face and say, hey, I can do it. We're not talking skills. We're talking spiritual fruit and vitality of life. And without Christ, you can do nothing. But with Christ, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's neat. And it's hard to sort that out sometimes. But it's that yieldedness. And so as we look at the core of our life, what do all these verses that we've looked at, what do they have in common?
God first.
Okay, God first. Another way of putting it. What are some other thoughts?
Seeking His will and lordship.
Okay. Seeking His will and lordship. And that, what I'm saying is that that's the irreducible minimum for life. And until we settle that, as it were, we're on a shaky foundation in our lives, our Christian life. And that's where the battle of the mind goes, that's where the battle of the will, that's where the battle of our thoughts are right on that subject, isn't it? Am I going to give God first place? And I find that myself. And it's not a one-time deal. It's not, 20 years ago I made that commitment. But it's today, like we were talking about last night. Take up your cross daily. And there's decisions that we're making day by day of whether we're going to put Christ first or not. In that conversation, in my purity, in my relationship with my wife, or whatever relationships I have, or job, or whatever, I'm in that process, aren't I? But if I've made the commitment, then when the decisions come, I'm just making another recommitment of the same thing. And God will take us to that point, each one of us. Okay, God, I'll sign the dotted line, the deed of my life, you can have it. And until we do, we're struggling. So that's the core. That's the first assumption that I have to make as far as my life is concerned. And the second assumption is that there are a lot of demands in life. Every one of us will agree to that. And I put down here, they ebb and flow in importance or significance and intensity. Issues come up in a life. But, and for you married men, if a man is married, his number one priority outside of this inner core of God first has to be his wife and his family. And as we look at the scripture in Ephesians 5, we see that it's husbands, love your wives at Valentine's Day, at Christmas time, and give them good gifts, and take care of the kids once in a while, and give them 5 minutes when you come home. Is that what it says? How are we to love our wives? Now, how did Christ love the church? He gave his all. He gave his life for the church. And God says, hey, here's the picture. You love your wife as God loved the church and gave himself for it. Now that is a tall order. And I cannot fulfill that tall order unless number one assumption is operating. No way. Because Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and then your neighbor as yourself. And I would include my wife as a pretty close neighbor. And, I can't get away, But that's, other relationships is what he's saying, is you love them like the number one priority that you have in your life of loving me. And the transfer goes. And so, and in fact, 1 Peter says, what does it say, 1 Peter, that reference there, 3:7? Some of you guys got it memorized. What's it say, 1 Peter 3:7? Someone read that once, then.
You husbands, likewise, conduct your married lives with understanding. Although your wife may be weaker physically, you should respect her as a fellow heir of the gift of life. If you don't, your prayers will be blocked.
Did you hear that? What is God saying in that little passage? Don, what's he saying?
He's saying, pay attention.
Okay.
Do your what?
And if you don't, what am I going to do?
Into your prayer.
Yeah. Do you find that the heavens are kind of like brass sometimes? And can you have a really rich prayer life when there's tension between you and your wife? Man, I find, you know, when Rosie and I are really communicating, I mean, whether we're in the same room or 100 miles away, I mean, there's a sense of peace and direction. And when we're not, I could be 1,000 miles away, and I, in my gut, I'm not free. I can pray till I'm blue in the face. And God says, hey, I'm sorry, Bruce, but I can't answer prayer until you get your relationship with your wife squared away. That's just one of the principles. He says, if you don't do this, I won't answer your prayer. Now, is that a pretty strong, high priority as far as God is concerned? And so as I look at this, and I look at this little target that I've got here, and trying to illustrate this so that men can grasp it. Here's the core. My relationship with God and my wife and children and family right here. That's the core. That's the power source of my life. And God says I need to have those things in harmony and working and operating. And out of that core flows the rest of life. And studies that you know, different businesses have done have found that a guy can be highly skilled in his profession, but what scuttles him in the business? Home life. Because he leaves his home, and if there's tension, he carries it to work, and he's not free, and it scuttles him. Or his moral life, if you want to put that. That will kill him. Not his profession, not his ability to do engineering or anything else. That is the least of the concern. But it's his core. And, you know, as we think about that, I mean, that's where it's at. I've got to have those two things in order. Let me give you a couple stories. John likes to tell stories, so I'll give you a story. When I've been involved in, of course, the NAV ministry since 1960, so it's been a while. And I've had the privilege of being involved in the NAVs in the military and in college ministries and in community ministry and business professional ministry. So there's a little bit of a broad spectrum of opportunity. And one time we were doing some surveys on the University of Missouri and surveying college students, you know, trying to get them involved in Bible study first of the year and bring them to a hot dog picnic and, you know, those kind of things. And so I went to the field house, and a guy was weightlifting and so forth, and I was just engaging in a conversation, began to talk to him about the Lord a little bit. Man, he just got an angry face on him. He says, I don't want any of that crap. And a few other choice words. And I said, man, I said, you really have some emotion in that. Can you tell me why you feel like you're saying that? Why you have so much emotion about the gospel? And he said, let me tell you. He said, my dad was a deacon in the church. And man, he was up saving everybody else's soul, and he didn't have any time for me. And I don't want any of that crap. I've had it stuffed down my throat and it doesn't work. Now, how do you witness to a guy like that? And in the very same day, I was talking to another guy, and he had almost the same testimony, and he said, my dad's a preacher. And he did everything, and we sat and suffered at home because of his ministry. And I don't want any of that stuff in my life. Now, boy, that, you know, I remember coming back from the campus, and I had two little kids at the time, and I'd made some decisions long before that about my family. But, man, that shook me. And I remember just saying, God, that is not going to happen to my kids. And I had to be steely hard on some things. And I was responsible for conferences and, you know, how you do a navigator stuff. And a lot of the guys that I knew left the kids at home. And they went off and did their ministry. And when I ran conferences, they got me and the family. And I had other nav guys say, hey, don't bring your family. I said, listen, you either, you know, I'm bringing my family, they're involved in this deal, and if you don't want that, you don't get me. And it's paid off. Because there wasn't any distinction, I think, in our kids of a ministry and life. And I mean, it's just, I mean, that's the way it is. And they went to conferences, they got involved in adults, and they were in, you know, it wasn't a big deal. And, you know, it's paid off. And I think in terms of, I've had men in Amarillo come to me, and I had one guy, maybe, and I shared this in another workshop years ago, but came to me with tears in his eyes, and he said, you know, I gave myself to the business and to retirement and trying to build the nest egg. And he said, I would give you everything that I've built up if I could have kids like yours. And just, you know, crying. And he's spending his retirement, quote, trying to put back his three kids together who are ricocheting off the walls. Well, all of them have had multiple marriages. I mean, he paid a high price. And they're dear folks, but it didn't work. Yeah.
Can I ask you something like that? What do you do when a relationship between family members falls off and the family members don't want to be forgiven and don't want to be reunited?
You mean like kids or?
Kids or brothers and sisters or mothers and daddies or. What do you do when somebody doesn't want to be forgiven?
You love them. You serve them. And pray for them.
Well, I had a preacher tell me that it doesn't say in the Bible that you have to love your mother or love your daddy. It just says you have to acknowledge that they are your parents. That's what he told me. So, they tell me the same thing when somebody doesn't want to be forgiven. You pity them, but then you go out.
Well, I don't think that it should scuttle your life, but I don't know, how do you guys respond to that? Okay.
That's hard for me to honor my dad if I'm not loving
him.
That's pretty close.
Now, I would have a little hard time with that because, oh, no man, what? Except
love him.
And if I'm to love God with all my heart and my neighbor is myself, that's going to spill over to relationships. And that love may be spurned like it is with Jesus, with the lost sinner. It's spurned, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't love him. For God so loved that he gave. And so I'd have a little difficult time with that idea that, you know, that doesn't mean that I don't have to work through some stuff if I've been hurt, you know, with my dad or whatever. But I have to make the effort.
Christ seems to have put the lover in.
Uh-huh. And forgive him. And that's the wrestling that we have to go through, is forgive them. And I think in this one situation I'm thinking of is that, and I've tried to talk to this friend of mine, if you would go to your kids and just humble yourself and say, listen, I blew it. I gave myself to the wrong priorities. I gave myself to business and not you kids. And it's paying a price in your life. And I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? It'd go a long ways. But he gets tangled up in their lifestyle and gets angry and mad at their lifestyle, and it continues the process.
First, in my own experience, I found that and there's no bad answers.
Yeah.
Especially in the divorce, children situation. But they mentioned to the kids that you were partially at fault. Because if you try to blame the other parent completely, they'll never buy it.
No.
Because they're hearing two stories.
Mm-hmm.
You just soon go ahead and say, hey, we both blew it.
Mm-hmm.
Kids understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Just soon or put that on the table. Then everything else you say, they'll listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to blame another parent, they won't listen to the word you say. They've already decided you were both wrong.
Mm-hmm. And it's not degree of blame, it's blame. And isn't that true with your wife or your kids? There's many times that I've had to go to my son or my daughter and say, you know, I was too harsh. And I was wrong. Or I got angry. Will you forgive me? And they're very eager to do that. But they're also, they'll hold a grudge for a long time if you don't. And I find I've got a teenage daughter, neat little gal. But there are times that I say things and, you know, I think it's perfectly great. And she's offended. You know, the hormones change things. And, you know, what was great a few years ago, it ain't good anymore. So I have to go to her often and say, you know, listen, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry for that comment or whatever. And my wife too.
There's a saying that I love that says, forgive a brother, transform his character and mine also.
Okay.
See, Bruce, it's not the response. We're not responsible for how someone responds. They may not accept love, forgiveness, but certainly when we are humble and don't try to make them feel guilty for an act or something they've done. I know my wife, years after we were married, she heard her father say for the first time he loved her. And she just broke down in tears. She said, I've never, ever heard him say, I love you. Although he did.
Mm-hmm.
He just never, ever expressed it.
He showed it by different things, but he had a hard time saying it.
So love does melt down all day.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we look at that, that's the core. That's where we're living out of. And then we have certain responsibilities, and I put this third assumption here as work. And, you know, God does give us authority and responsibility. And you could put in there in Genesis and the idea that he gave us authority over all the earth to subdue it, to bring it in subjection, you know, to utilize all the things that he created to give us. And we're part of that discovery and manipulation of it and working of it and so forth. That's what work is. And, you know, the responsibility that all men work, and our society doesn't necessarily want to agree to that, but, you know, when we talk about the idea of if a man don't work, he don't eat, that would really, you know, that would change the welfare deal pretty easily, wouldn't it?
Amen.
I mean, if you say, listen, buddy, if you don't work, you don't eat. And you know what? A guy gets about four meals away from having a meal, and he's willing to do almost anything. And that would change. I mean, that would be a real welfare deal change right there. But the idea is to provide for, to manage his walk with the Lord, his family, and his livelihood is really what we're talking about, is life management, isn't it? And, you know, work is a very important part of life, and we spend most of our time doing it, as far as hours are concerned. But if I am not steely hard in protecting the core, my relationship with God and my family, what happens? Work will take over. And it can easily become the number one or number two priority in our life without even giving it a blink of the eye. And I have to be steely hard in keeping that in focus and priority. Otherwise, it'll get out of whack.
That's got to be the hardest ongoing battle. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in business for yourself, or how many are in business for yourself? I mean, when is your work done? Huh? I mean, we're still praying for that 28 or 30 hour work day. You know, it doesn't happen, but it just. And if you're in any kind of profession, ministry or whatever that, I mean, when is the job done? It's never done. I mean, at least if you got an 8-hour day job, I mean, you punch the time clock and you punch it and you leave. And for the most part, you can forget about it until you get back and punch it in again. But if you're in business for yourself or got a consulting deal or a career or some, you know, that you're doing, I mean, it just goes on. And that's where the guy gets the trap. He feels like he's providing for his family indirectly, you know, by bringing the paycheck home and supplying all the goods at home, and he's losing it because it's out of whack. And how many guys have ended up that? Well, you know, you look at these verses on work. Colossians 3:17 says, whatever you do in word or deed, do what? Do all to the glory of Christ. And he says in you know, servants obey, or workers obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as a men pleaser, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God, and whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord. Isn't that neat? Don't do it to please the boss. Do it heartily as unto the Lord, and you'll be a valued worker. You'll be one of those guys that the boss can count on. And confidence in an unfaithful man in the time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. And I've had guys, you know, that were great-looking guys, and you start leaning them on them a little bit, and you're counting on them, and it's like pulling the rug out, and it's like vapor. You can't count on them. And that's the employee you're going to get rid of because you can't trust them. He may be a great analysis or got great talents or anything else, but he's not going to cover it in your business. So he says, whatever you do, do it heartily as in the Lord, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance. God is the payer back of the service that you do. And it's not the paycheck you're working for. And that's hard to get in mind too. It's God who you're trying to serve and work for. And the paycheck is kind of a benefit, but not the motivation. And, you know, that's hard to wrestle through. But until we settle that, we're in bondage as eye service to those who are in authority. We're in bondage to them. You know, you have to kind of wrestle that one through a little bit. Ecclesiastes 9:10. I should have had 9:9 up in the other part there. Live joyfully with the wife of your youth.
The living is better.
What's that?
Live happily with the woman you love through the fleeting days of life. The wife that God gives you is your best reward for all your earthly toil.
Okay. Is your best reward. Isn't that neat? And then he says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Pretty good philosophy, isn't it? There's a couple of jokes floating around about taking you with you, but I'll spare you of them. But work. You know, it's fun to work. I mean, I get a lot of enjoyment out of work. And, you know, the Bible talks about that, that it's work that's really puts meaning to life. And that's what Ecclesiastes talks about, that it's your reward. That it's part of life, and that you get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. But as the cartoon that we were looking at, I think because guys don't settle who they're really working for or what they're really working for, they're frustrated, and he says it doesn't pay off. And so therefore he says, whatever your hand finds to do it with all your might, for there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you go. But the idea is that you rejoice in your labor because this is a gift of God. And when we look at that, and that's Ecclesiastes 5:19, that God, work is a gift. And as you work unto the Lord, it really nourishes your soul. There's a desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, it says. And that's your reward. And as we put that in perspective, it comes out of, again, as I mentioned, it comes out of the source. As we have here the core and the family in tune, then I can go work and enjoy it. Because I've got the support from the core, the hub of my life. And as we look at that on that other bottom of the page there on this handout, you know, work could be placed as one of life's responsibilities, you know, one of them. But in order to place it in proper perspective, it has to be the third priority. Because that's what we're giving our time to. And I say most men live at home, but they do very little by way of management of the family. They leave that to their wives. And that's a tragedy. But work. You know, it's fun to work. I mean, I get a lot of enjoyment out of work. And, you know, the Bible talks about that, that it's work that's really puts meaning to life. And that's what Ecclesiastes talks about, that it's your reward. That it's part of life, and that you get a great deal of enjoyment out of it. But as the cartoon that we were looking at, I think because guys don't settle who they're really working for or what they're really working for, they're frustrated, and he says it doesn't pay off. And so therefore, he says, whatever your hand finds to do it with all your might, for there's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you go. But the idea is that you rejoice in your labor because this is a gift of God. And when we look at that, and that's Ecclesiastes 5:19, that God, work is a gift. And as you work unto the Lord, it really nourishes your soul. There's a desire accomplished is sweet to the soul, it says. And that's your reward. And as we put that in perspective, it comes out of, again, as I mentioned, it comes out of the source. As we have here the core and the family in tune, then I can go work and enjoy it. Because I've got the support from the core, the hub of my life. And as we look at that on that other bottom of the page there on this handout, you know, work could be placed as one of life's responsibilities, you know, one of them. But in order to place it in proper perspective, it has to be the third priority, because that's what we're giving our time to. And I say most men live at home, but they do very little by way of management of the family. They leave that to their wives. And that's a tragedy. Yeah, Doug?
This is something I've wrestled with a lot. Would it work to evaluate a profession that maximizes my time with Christ and my family? Would that be fair to my family? Because probably, well, in my case, it would mean a reduction in my standard of living. Would that be fair to them? I mean, you see what I'm saying? That kind of plugs part of taking care of your wife and your family is how your wife provides for you. And that's something I've really struggled with, because I could choose to go and find something that is a time block. I'm in sales right now, and it's really like having my own business. It's never ending. It's endless. I could work 24 hours a day setting up programs and doing seminars and staying after these people. And I could be in service and staff at hospitals and on and on and on. I could really lay it out there. But, you know, the other side of that coin, I could choose, you know, to do...
Let me ask you a question. How do some of the other men who have kind of an open-ended deal like that make the choices?
I think in sales you have to narrow, and this is what I found, I'm in sales, you have to narrow down your customer base. This is who's making you the money and where's the big account.
Right.
Forget about the other guys, because they're just going to waste your time and they're not going to financially bring you that much, and they're going to take that time away from your family and other things. So, do what you can with the big guys and delve into them, but don't be messing around with all those other guys. And that way, that, you know, instead of this thing, like you say, it looks endless. Well, if you knock your customer base down, it doesn't look so endless.
Okay, that's one. What's another? How do you do it?
Ask your wife.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can take an inside job. I'm selling food. I mean, it costs us 35-40% of our strength. You know, mm-hmm. You can live on it, you know. And usually she doesn't have to. Anyway, but that's not.
Yeah.
That's not the truth. And then again, what parents said, you know, this I have to constantly deal with my employer to sell him on the idea that not cost effective to deal with all these little nickel and dimers that kill you on time. The best way they always did, and that they just thought that's essential, and you have to show them, that, hey guys.
Okay.
I should have prefaced mine, but I'm single.
Well, next question to you. Does your client base, does it have the potential to change?
A little bit.
Are you locked into a product line? See, my product line changes constantly.
Yeah, mine doesn't.
The guys that are not big dollar guys today are big dollar guys tomorrow.
Right, you're probably right. That doesn't change that much with me, because I deal with hydraulics and pneumatics. So it's an industrial account. You're either a big plant or you're not a big plant. You're either a big buyer or not. And you're not going to all of a sudden, you know, explode. You're a big tire or you're not. You know.
That's it.
Go ahead.
No line to speak with the same authority, but from another viewpoint, you have to look at your standard of living. What are you calling your necessities?
Rivals, yeah.
I've given up a lot, but I haven't missed it. I've given up a lot of potential, but I haven't missed it. By not living beyond what I... Putting things away and not getting used to things that some people would like to have, but I haven't missed them because I never have. And God, if you get that right, maybe that'll answer your question.
I'd say I'm an estimate guy. You know, I walk away from a job based on time. I was working 8 to 9 hour weeks. It's coming to me, it's coming to my husband. God, my wife, my son, it's job based on time. Ended up getting an immediate raise. I'm making a lot of money. But only based on, I took the job simply because I knew it would be more time, less time than I did.
We're making choices, aren't we? And I know guys who are in sales or insurance or whatever, and they look at their time and say, listen, you know, I'm going to allocate so much time for this job. And if God can't provide within that time frame, then he can't provide. I mean, God is able to provide within a, you know, a 50-hour week just as well as he can provide in a 60 or 70-hour week. And we get snookered into the idea that we put 70 hours in, I'm going to get a 30% more increase in income. And maybe it's just a drain time. And we say, listen, I'm going to put 40 hours or I'm going to put 50 hours in this deal. And that's it. And God, you know, you provide within that framework. And if I can't do it within that framework, I guess I'll have to do something else. And I think management seminars, what they try to do is to give you tools so that you can do two or three jobs, you know, in the same amount of time. And they call that success. And it's a treadmill, they'll kill you. And what God holds us responsible for is the time frame that we have, not, you know, multiplying it out so I can do two, three jobs. And there's a little hook to that. And that's what business today is trying to do, is get you to do two, three jobs, you know, in your thinking. So you're running like a chicken with your head cut off through life all the time. And they don't care about the number one and number two priority. They're just looking at the bottom line. But if you pray about it and commit that to God, I believe that the bottom line can be very acceptable within the framework of your priorities.
I think one thing, just because the illustration is so strong, a friend of mine, we drove down and we just saw this little big shack, and this guy had about three cows, and he had about 3 acres over there, and he had a little pond. And that was it, out in the middle of nowhere, you know. And my friend goes, well, what does he do to make him, you know, I mean, that, you know, and he looked poor and all that. And I said, you know, and what I thought, just because I'm kind of unhappy with what I'm doing right now, because I've let my job kind of just over consume me, is that that's probably the happiest guy in the United States right now. You know? He doesn't have to worry about the time.
Amen.
Bruce,
yeah.
I'm just going to say, you talked about bosses having the wrong perspective. I'm just reading the Lee Iacocca's this book. He said even the CEO of Chrysler, you can imagine what they went through. He worked, he said, you know, weekdays, I don't know how many hours, probably a lot, but he said he was off every Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, and Sunday night he planned his week. He looked at these guys, they were working 100 hours a week, and go, what's the matter with you? You're working on an $80 million account, and you can't figure out how to take weekends off with your family. And again, the boss, that's like you just said, the boss is the problem sometimes, but you have to figure it out.
Because, you remember, the focus is you serve the Lord, and then God is a rewarder. Don't serve to please men. And there's a subtle thing. If you're in management, you're trying to please your boss, so you surmise that, well, if I come in early and stay late, he's going to look at me more favorably and I'll get the position, and you know, you can't, and you're hoodwinked. And who are you serving? Him, not Christ.
Well, and in a sense, we get caught up in our work to the point where it's part of our ego. We're serving ourselves and being that egotistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was guilty of that as well.
And God,
it's not even the ball.
No, it trips up. It trips us up. Well, look at here. It says, you know, most men neglect their wives and therefore do not nurture them and care for them as Christ loved the church. The real world for them is their work. This granted is an important part of life, but if the hub of life is not functioning, all of life will be out of focus. If we neglect the core responsibilities, we will find that our energies now are being poured into civic, social, hobbies, church, recreation, ministries to our own detriment and demise. And that's the next point of that, is the fourth assumption of life activities and involvements. Every one of us has the task of sorting through the many, many options for our discretionary time.
I think the biggest tyrant is the church.
Okay. And let's look at that. You know, you have to juggle those time allotments, church, ministry, social, recreation time, and so forth. And Jesus talks about the fact that if you don't, it says in Luke 8, that the cares of this life will come and choke the word, and he becomes unprofitable. It's like this giant squeeze that comes in. And you mentioned church. If you're a men pleaser, then somebody's going to come up to you and say, "Boy, Tony, you are just the man for the job." And what happens? "Oh, man, I didn't know I was so important here. Sign me right up there." And you get on a committee, and it consumes your life. And then... Well, and because you did such a good job with that, would you please take this other responsibility? Would you get on this board? And would you help us? And you know what? I find that, again, going back, if I don't have this in focus, and I don't have this core, the hub of my life in focus, work will begin to take my time, and these outside activities will eat my lunch. You know why? Because this is like a spinning wheel. And it's going to spin out, you know, the centrifugal force is going to spin my energies out to the outer core. And I know guys who are involved in hobbies or social or other things, they can't even hardly get to their work, let alone here. Isn't that right? When a guy says, "Man, I don't have time to have a quiet time," what's he saying? It's not part of his core curriculum. But I also notice that he's out on the golf course every single Friday afternoon and all day Saturday and Sunday too. Now, where's his priority? Where is he living his life? This center has spun out so that his life now is engagements of activities that boost him up. And people look at him and say, "Boy, Clarence, you are really a great golfer. And man, that's enough to keep me going for a week." Or, "We sure need you on this committee, and you've done a great job," let alone his little kids back there are suffering, like the illustration I gave you of the two guys that I witnessed to, and they were adamant against what I had to say because Dad was in here working his tail off and he wasn't in here meeting the needs of his family. And I can only have the wisdom to make these kind of decisions when this is in order. The priorities. Morley, in his book Man in the Mirror, makes these statements. You don't have it written down, but life's many options compete for our priority list like a well-stocked shelf of a grocery store. To have any control over our lives whatsoever, we must decide in advance what we will give ourselves to. The objective of setting priorities is to allocate limited amounts of time and money where God directs, but all too often we choose our priorities with the same foresight as a trip to the grocery store. And the things we give priority are simply not, you know, are too simply not what our family needs or what God wants, but what we see on the shelf and take it kind of idea. According to Webster's Dictionary, a priority is something we give precedence by assigning a degree of urgency or importance to it. Most men have not settled the issue of what their priority should be, and among those who do know, two feel live according to those priorities. He says, what's important to God? The answer reveals what our priorities ought to be. Priorities help us to narrow our focus. What are God's priorities for man's life? Has God already made out a shopping list for us, he says? As we explore God's priorities, we have to keep four angles in view. What does God want me to be and do? Number two, how does God want me to use my time and my money? The third one, what character or conduct traits does God desire in men? That's purity of life and honesty and all those things. And then what relationships and tasks does God want me to emphasize with my life? And that's calling. That's priority systems. That's life management. And every single one of us have more demands on our lives than we're able to fulfill. No question about it. But where's the cutoff point? Where do you say no is enough? That's it. And I've got men who are, we're going through a little exercise using this on-purpose person. And if you look at that little handout sheet, there's some neat quotations that have to do with an on-purpose person. Out of chaos, here it says, the man without a purpose is like a ship without a rudder, a waif, a nothing, a no man. Have a purpose in life and have it with throwing such strength and mind and muscle into your work as God has given to you. It sounds a little bit like Ecclesiastes as Thomas Carlyle. But most men don't have a purpose, so they're like a ship, just whatever. If the boss says, hey, it would sure be nice if you could do that, and because you're a men pleaser, yeah, I'll do it. Let alone it kills that family time that you had or whatever else. And if a guy would stand up and say, you know, boss, I would really like to do that, but I've got a couple other priorities here that if I do that, I'm going to really be in a world of hurt, and I'm not going to be able to do the job that you want me to do with this other thing. So maybe I can shift some priorities around. I'd be happy to do it, but I don't think I can do that. And I find it hard to work with men in the church context to be able to tell the pastor or somebody on the deacon committee or the nomination committee or the other committees that are, you know, trying to get my time, to be able to say, you know, I really am flattered by this request, but that's not within my priorities. And I've determined that I'm going to do one job well here in the church, but that's it. And you'll have to get somebody else. Now I'll recommend Joe, because I think Joe needs to be involved. But when in any organization, when they see a guy that has a little bit together, they're going to just heap it on until he can't do anymore. And then when he crashes, they'll say, poor Joe, and they're heaping it on somebody else. Yeah.
Reason manager appreciates the same thing. They assume that we're all motivated by money and goals like they are. And if you'll just tell them that you have family priorities, that my goal isn't the same as your goal, they appreciate that. They really do.
And they want, you know, most of them want to do that in their own life, so it's a challenge for them. Look at this little quote. We can define purpose in several ways. For one, when we know our purpose, we have an anchor, the core, isn't it? a device of the mind provides some stability to keep the surprises of creative universe from tossing us to and fro, from inflicting constant seasickness on us. Or we can think of our purpose as being a master nautical chart making shoals and rocks and sandbars and I don't know what, I never seen that, but that's an old English word, derelicts. Some kind of ship deal. Something to guide us and keep us on course. Perhaps the most profound thing we can say about being on purpose is that when that is our status, our condition, and our comfort, we find that our lives have meaning. And when we're off purpose, we're confused about meanings and motives. You find that true in your life? That's true. The man who sees above his fellows is the one who early in life or early in his career clearly discerns his object or objective and towards that objective habitually directs his powers. Even genius itself is but fine observation strengthened by fixity of purpose. Every man who observes valiantly or vigilantly and resolves steadfastly grows unconsciously into genius. 1800. That's where we're at. And God wants us, each one of us, to be a success. And we started out by live purposefully, worthily, and accurately, not as the unwise or witless, but as wise, sensible, intelligent people, making the very most of your time, buying up each opportunity because the days are evil. And in order for me to do that, again, we come back to this little illustration, and I find that it's very descriptive. There's my source. If I'm going to operate successfully in the realms of my energies, this better be in focus. And I give myself to that as my number one priority, the hub. And these, then I can do as unto the Lord, not unto men, and I can give myself to them in the time that I've allotted. It's not a question of time. I mean, the question of, you know, a lot of times we get frustrated, these are number one priority, these are number two priorities, and how can I justify giving 60 hours of work when this is should be my number one priority and I'm only given, you know, an hour quiet time or, you know, a couple hours Bible study a week or whatever. That's not it. It's a question of priority up here. And when I'm at work and I've allowed 50 hours to that job, I can do that with whole heart as unto the Lord and give it all the gas I got because it's one of my priorities. And the same way, if I've got a church responsibility and I've decided that I'm going to do that responsibility and I've allocated the time for it, when I'm doing that job, I don't feel that I'm tearing away from my wife or that because I'm doing it as unto the Lord with a priority system. Now, if I'm running to 16 things, I'm not going to do anything well. And I think one of the hardest things is getting men off of boards and responsibilities that they were like the shopping. They're going along with their shopping cart and say, gee, that looks kind of good. I'll take that on. Gee, that looks kind of good. And they don't have a shopping list. They don't have a priority of why they're there. And pretty soon they got this basket full of 19 things they don't need and responsibilities that they've added onto their life because they haven't had a priority of where they're going to put their time.
See, I think one of my problems is those things just keep sneaking up on me. Yeah. I don't realize it at the time. And then once someone helps me see that, I've gotten involved in this accountability groups, through the 2-7 series, and then we have one called HIT Team, Husbands in Training. So the 2-7 helps me with my walk with God, the HIT Team with my family life, and I think accountability groups with close friends really help keep on track.
Okay. Was this helpful? Does it kind of help you focus? Yeah.
This I found about the most helpful thing getting me out of some of the dilemma of unsettling to and whatever like that for it. I have to set out with my wife that I calendar 2 or 3 months in advance and plan some time. learned in advance. That calendar's already full. And that's really helped us to just plug those times in. And I don't care what happens. I don't tell the customer. I just say, I already have a commitment. I don't tell them it's my family. That's none of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you say, well, I'm going to have a day with my family, he'll say, well, you can move that around. I didn't say, no. I'm already busy that day.
Good point. Why don't we shut that off?